This is Malcolm Duck, and you're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to more golf on the radio and another episode of Radio Golf Show. As you know, we not only think outside the box when it comes to content and stories in and around the game of golf, we live outside the box. And today's show is just another example of that and of our mission statement of change culture. Our love for everything Scottish is no secret either, and we are excited to explore and learn during the next 45 minutes or so about another pillar of Scotland's cultural heritage, the tartan. Joining us from Oban, the charming harbour town on the west coast of the Scottish Highlands, is Scottish tartan designer Alan Moore. Dear Alan, we're happy to have you visit. Welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having me. Very excited to be on. First German podcast that I've been on. I've not done many, but this is the first German one. So, excited to be on. That was really nice kind of chatting just before we started recording there and getting a kind of idea of who you are and what you do and your passion for the game and for culture definitely comes across. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Well, now I'm under the gun to perform, but we'll see. Thanks again for being here. And it's always exciting for us to open the door to a new room, especially one that bears the sign of something as culturally significant as the tartan. As we wander through our conversation, we will surely learn many things about you and your business. But why don't we start with this? What is tartan? Is it a fabric? Is it a pattern? Is it both? What is it?
Mm-hmm. So we could be very philosophical and say that tartan's a way of thinking. I might get some stick for that, but tartan is about storytelling. The origins of tartan, when we strip it back, tartan is woven lamb's wool in a check. So to be kind of technical and specific, the warp threads have to match the weft threads. So that means that the yarns going up and down the cloth have to be the same as the yarns going side to side in the cloth. Mm-hmm. So tartan is made up of different colours of checks, like different lines. Within those lines, within those yarns, within those numbers and kind of mechanics of it are stories. So if we go way back when, kind of very old times in Scotland, sort of 12, 13, 14, even before that, people were weaving tartan in Scotland. And it was nothing to do with clans or families or areas or anything like that. It was simply design. These people would have sheep and other animals kind of roaming about their land. They would shear the sheep or find the wool that's kind of fallen off the sheep, and they would dye it using natural plant dyes that were available to them. So they would grind up different flowers and different plants and make dyes. Different kind of strengths would make different intensities, and then it would be woven into this checked fabric. So there would be no sense of story or meaning behind the fabric other than telling the story of place. I think it's a very inherently human thing to want to tell the story of where you are or where you've been or what you're doing. You know, think about today, everyone takes photos on their phone of the places they go, the places they visit, their home. I've got a picture of my home and as a background of my screen here. That's what tartan was, and I think that story and that desire to tell other people where you're from and what your place looks like, I think is true, 500 years ago, and it will be true 500 years from now. That will never change. Mm-hmm. between then and now, there's a lot of history and a lot of politics and a lot of bloodshed and a lot of different advancements in time and how tartan is produced. But we can kind of get into that in a moment. But essentially, what tartan does is it's a fabric that tells a story.
Okay. Is it true that it can be dated in Scotland back to the 3rd or 4th century?
So there was the one of the first pieces of tartan ever found was found in a clay pot with full of Roman coins, and this was they were again it was in kind of central Scotland, a sort of not very exciting part of Scotland. They were digging a housing development, and they were digging foundations, and someone put a spade into the ground and cracked this pot, and out fell these coins and this little bit of tartan. So that was one of the oldest pieces of tartan, a kind of checked black and white bit of fabric. I don't know exactly the date that that goes back to, so I'm not gonna kind of hazard a guess at it. But one of the kind of oldest pieces of coloured tartan was found recently, the last kind of few years, in a peat bog in Glenafric. Glenafric's kind of estate a bit further north, and it was found in this peat bog, and it was found by historians, and they carbon dated it, and they matched the colours, and they had it woven again in a sort of exact replica, which is now available to buy and things through one of the tartan mills today. So, but I mean, it's woven fabric goes back to the Egyptian times, and there's nothing to say that it wasn't done, for since the beginning of time, really.
Exactly. I mean, I guess everywhere there was woven cloth, people created these tartan designs. Why does it have such a cultural significance in Scotland? Is that something?
That jumps forward a few hundred years, and goes into the whole sort of Jacobite rebellion and the clan system and things like that. So the Jacobites, the Highlanders, would adopt tartan, and you'll see all these old paintings of these people wearing very short kilts, and so these were it was. We call it the Philomore, or the great kilt. Gaelic is Philomore, the great kilt is the English, and it was a very long piece of woven fabric, woven in tartan, woven in a check, and it would be pleated on the floor, and then the Highlander would lie down, put a belt under it, and then wrap it around them, and then this would be kind of like a shawl and a kilt as well, one bit of fabric that served a lot of different purposes. And so with that, they would use it to trade with. They would use it to keep warm, like this. When wool gets wet, it gets kind of heavy, and if you kind of wrap it around at night, it does become warm, and the warmth from the wool and your body heat keep you warm through the night. If you got injured, you could tear a bit off and kind of wrap it around the injury. So it was this really sort of multifunctional piece of fabric. That was really used by the Highlanders to clothe themselves, essentially. And I do like whisky talks and things, and we always get someone up to try on this great kilt. And we say, when the Romans came to invade, you would undo your belt, take out your sword, and then all the fabric drops to the floor. And that's what these guys did. They were running about the Highlands with swords, with no clothes on, fighting the Romans and scaring everyone off. But the sort of the what we know now as the kilt and as tartan is quite different from then. So that was used by the Highlanders. It was more of a cultural thing, just cultural and functional. There was wool there. There was very harsh conditions, and they needed something that was easy to get on and off, easy to make, and could trade with and things like that. So that was the Highlanders. Then the Jacobite rebellion and the Jacobite story came about. The tartan was then banned after the Jacobite rebellion. There was the so this is a whole big story that we could talk for hours about this, and there'll be facts in and out that aren't that I'm not getting exactly right. But as a kind of summary, tartan was outlawed in certain aspects. So there was certain exceptions to the rule, but essentially Highlanders. were not allowed to wear tartan as it was a sign of the rebellion. So the English and the British king didn't want another Jacobite uprising, didn't want any sort of rebellion at all. So anyone who was caught wearing tartan above the Highland line and was a man, there was pretty dire consequences to it. And so it was outlawed for a long time. Then it was brought back, it was revived with Sir Walter Scott.
Scottish literature.
Yeah, so Sir Walter Scott wrote a book called Kidnapped, and it was all about a young Scottish man traveling through the islands and through the Highlands and through Scotland, and it was a novel very much of the time. It was very romanticized about Scotland. It was all about, you know, it was kind of Outlander style stuff. It was kind of big burly Scots guys and kind of dainty English women, and the Londoners and the kind of high society really took to this idea of Scotland being this very rugged, very romantic place. So Scotland had this kind of enlightenment of and a sort of renaissance of culture. There was also the Edinburgh London Society of, I'm going to get that wrong. It was kind of well-to-do gentlemen based in London, who wanted to bring back tartan after the outlaw of the cloth. They wanted to bring it back, and it became this real fashion piece. So there was a few exceptions to the outlawing of tartan. It could be worn by the military. That was the big one. So the clans who had sworn allegiance to the king and who were now kind of under British rule were allowed to wear tartan. So they were encouraged to wear tartan. And that's that you'll hear the Black Watch. So the Black Watch was an army regiment, and they wore the Black Watch tartan. So the tartan that they wore, called the Black Watch, it's also the exact same as the Campbell clan. The Campbell clan were very important in building this Black Watch army. There's a lot of kind of history that I'm glazing over here, and purists will maybe come at me for that. But I think I'm kind of summarizing it quite well. So the Campbell clan.
So. Yeah, and I don't think we have so many tartan purists in.
Well, you never know. You never know. So yeah, the Campbell clan were sort of really influential in building Black Watch. So their family tartan became the Black Watch tartan that you know today, and it was part of the army. And then so these army regiments were formed, and they were each told that they had to have a tartan. They had to have a tartan designed. There was a weaver's in Bannockburn, which is kind of near Stirling, it's kind of central Scotland. So one of the exceptions to the rule was you could wear tartan below the Highland line. So that was kind of south of Stirling. So Bannockburn was kind of right in the middle there. So they were allowed to weave tartan because they kind of came out of they wove the tartan for the military as well. So they had to kind of favour to do it. So the clan chiefs had to go to Bannockburn and to visit this weavers, and they had to have their tartan designed by them. So they had these tartans designed. They made up kilts and tartans for the military. And then the reason... One of the reasons that tartan is so well associated with Scotland is because at that time there was still some, you know, civil unrest. There was still some Jacobite affiliation, and the best way to kind of quash that was to get the Scottish people out of Scotland. So they formed these military units using the best soldiers, the most able men. They were sworn allegiance to the king, and then they were sent across the world to different continents, different colonies, to kind of do the work of the British. And so people in places like Singapore and Hong Kong and all these far flung places were seeing all these men in kilts coming off boats and they were all from Scotland. So the association was, if you're from Scotland, you must dress like that, because that's all we know. So yeah, that's a very high level answer to that.
I want to pick up on two things you said. Number one, you mentioned the Campbell clan, and as far as I know, in the year 1800, there were maybe 90 to 100 named tartans. Today, there are about 7,000. Do they all have names?
Yeah, so there's the yeah, so there's a couple of things. There's the Scottish Register of Tartans, which is run by the Scottish Tartans Authority. I think I've got that right. So what that is a kind of small collective of people of experts on tartan who have it's a kind of government register of tartans that are official tartans. So these are fabrics that people have designed and registered with the registry. They've had them woven, and within those tartans, they tell a story. They've been woven for a certain purpose. So whether it's for a new family, or if it's for a business or a charity or a sports club or something like that, it's registered and recognised through the Tartans Authority. So they are, yeah, I suppose a kind of record keepers, and a kind of cultural asset really, so that people can look back and say, well, why was this tartan designed? And you can go back to, you know, it started off as a very small record, as you say, with just a few tartans that were associated with different families, but now it's a record of every tartan that's been woven. Some tartans don't get registered with it, but people that want to kind of make a lasting kind of legacy with it will go through the process of registering it. Yeah, but you know, going back to the family tartans, we'll come back to your second question in a second. The family tartans. So there's a few stories about how they came to be. The big story, the main one that people kind of believe or are told, the main one that people are told is that every tartan has meaning and every tartan has a story. So that's the first story that everyone's told. The second story, once you start reading into tartan and history, the second story is that the clan chiefs were conned by these two guys called the Stabosky Stuarts. So two gentlemen, two brothers, who I don't even know if they were brothers. They might not have been brothers. They were. They went around all the clans and said that they were direct descendants of Charles Edward Stuart, so Bonnie Prince Charlie. They said they were the great grandson of Bonnie Prince Charlie, and they held all these manuscripts that were passed down to them, and they were completely fake. They were made up. But within those manuscripts and documents and clan documents was a book of tartans, which they claimed to be the original book of clan tartans. And it had all the ancient clans like Robertson and Gordon and Douglas and all the big ones. So these guys went round all the estates, all the clan chiefs, and said, you know, this is your tartan. This is going back to your great great grandfather, and this is what your clan tartan is. And they were entertained, they were wined and dined, and they were, you know, they were seen as the real deal. And a lot of the clan chiefs bought it and said, great, that's our tartan, register that's our tartan. So then there's a couple of reactions to that story. There's the reaction that
Oh,
most people
con job.
say, yeah, so there's the reaction that most people say is that, well, the clan chiefs were conned. The Stabosky Stuarts were total con men, and the tartans actually mean nothing. They're meaningless. They're just made up. And these guys were con men, and they're made up. So that's one way to view it. My view is that there's an element of truth in that. Yes, these guys could have been frauds, but that's not to say that the tartans had no meaning. I think if you meet any person from Scotland, they love to tell a story. They are very romantic, very passionate. So I find it very surprising that someone would just pick something out of a book. I think there would be quite a lot of time spent saying, oh, I like this, and I like this because of this. And even when they were designing their tartans with the mill, with ba Wilson's of Bannockburn, I think there would have been a lot of conversation to say, well, why are we going to have red through this? Why have we got green? Like, yeah, that looks like this and that looks like this. Why have we got bright yellow here? Well, that reminds me of home. So I think there's more to it than just they were conned and they went with it. I don't think that's very believable from my
That
experience.
sounds like a movie to be
So
made.
yeah, oh, definitely, definitely, yeah. Yeah, so I went on a kind of sidetrack there, but you had two questions, so
Yeah, the
go
other
back to
one
the second
you
one then.
mentioned fashion pieces, and then at some point along came, I think in the 1920s, maybe if I'm correct, Burberry.
Yeah.
What significance did that play?
So Burberry and like fashion kind of tartans and things. They are something I'm not hugely well versed in sort of Barbarian fashion tartans and the history on them, but they are the sort of thing that brings tartan and Scottish culture into light every few years, every couple of decades. Same with like Vivienne Westwood and with Alexander McQueen. You know, these designers will sort of borrow, I don't want to say borrow, they'll take inspiration from Scottish culture and use things like tartan and Scottish themes within collections, which is totally cool. It's great. I think tartan is timeless. It should be celebrated at all times. It should be kind of used to inspire people all the time. But with these, when big designers like that use tartan and use Scottish culture, it brings other aspects of Scottish culture into the frame. And you'll usually find that around those times, there'll be other things going on. There'll be like Scotland are in the World Cup at the moment. They're going to be in the World Cup in June. It's the first time they've been in the World Cup since 1998.
Yeah, I love them.
And it's so there will be more, you'll see more about Scotland because of that. And, you know, there will be other sort of political things going on that will bring light to Scotland. And
it's called the supporters are called the Tartan Army.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Best supporters in the world. I'm sure every nation says the same. But yeah, when designers and things bring Scottish culture to the populace, I suppose, it brings into light other parts of Scottish culture at that time. So it's a good thing, I think.
Yeah. I was walking around today and it wasn't intentional, but I was wearing one of those Canadian lumberjack shirts that are, I guess, in a tartan design.
Yeah.
And I ran into an acquaintance of mine, Professor Dr. Martin Schaefer, who is an expert on German folklore. And he told me this, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on that. And he said that there's an old saying that the smaller the checks on a farmer's shirt, the wealthier he is.
Okay.
Have you ever heard that?
I've never heard it. I'm trying to think why it might be. It could be a way of weaving it is maybe more expensive, or it was it more expensive to do kind of smaller checks or something. I don't know. I've not heard it, but I'd be interested to find out what the actual meaning was behind it.
Well, Professor also got his shout out.
There you go. But within tartan design, there was different colours did represent different sort of social status. Like red was always looking at textile dyeing and things. Red was a very expensive fabric to produce because of the nature of the dye. It was it's called cochineal, which is little bugs. It's these little red bugs from like South America that have to be crushed up and exported. And it's very, very expensive to do that. So like you'll see a lot of old paintings with guys wearing big red bits of tartan, and that's a sign of wealth, because at that time red fabric was very expensive, very hard to come by. A lot of these paintings, they might not have had any tartan, but said, you know, we want to project our wealth, so paint me with some red tartan. So
I'm going with the weight symbolizes wealth. That's what I'm going with.
yeah. Okay.
Standing up, but let's talk about you, Alan. You were born in Glasgow?
Yes. Yeah.
What year was that?
1986.
Okay. 1986. Oh, yeah. Not so long ago. I got married in 87. At what age did you start to design things?
Hey, that's a good question. So I think I've always been interested in drawing and building things and kind of putting things together. As long as I can remember, I was always drawing, always interested in drawing, whether it was drawing like cartoons or buildings or just anything. I was always drawing, and that was through the kind of primary school up into even in high school. I was drawing constantly. And then in high school, I was interested in architecture. I was quite interested in how things went together, how things not just looked nice, but how do things actually work together and actually kind of structurally work. So I was kind of convinced that I was going to go into architecture, and I met an architect, and it put me off architecture. I thought, I don't really want to do that. I found it, I don't know, I didn't have a great experience of, he was telling me about what architecture was, and it wasn't really what I thought it was going to be. So that kind of put me off that path. But in high school, I was still at high school and considering what to do next, and visited the Glasgow School of Art, and I visited the textile department in Glasgow School of Art. And that brought everything together. There was so much drawing. It was very focused on drawing and mark making and things like that, but very experimental as well. So it was really hands-on. It was about building things. It was about putting different materials together. It was about creating materials from nothing, a lot of experimentation. Very hands-on, very material-led. So I knew that's what I wanted to do. As soon as I saw it, I thought, I want to be here. I want to continue studying here. And then it was actually quite a while after graduating art school that I kind of found my way. I graduated thinking that I wanted to be in fashion, and kind of proper fashion, but didn't really quite make it. And for several reasons, just didn't really want to be in the industry. It was really that sort of textile design industry that I really enjoyed. But it's quite a small industry, especially in Scotland, and at that time as well. So I graduated in 2008, and the textile industry was, I mean, it was doing really well, but it was a very closed industry in that there wasn't really a scene for printmaking or embroidery. There was a knitwear industry and a weaving industry, but they were very, very closed door. It was very much, you know, you had to have been working there for years and years to get into any sort of design sort of path with it. So yeah, but it was a different time. There was no, like, they didn't take on interns, they didn't take on work experience, they didn't do collaborations, there was no like social media. These places were just quite industrial places. Huge businesses and great export businesses, but difficult to get into, for sure.
So it was a hobby that became a passion, or a passion that just developed. Do you remember when you realized that you could make a living doing this?
So when I came out of art school, I wanted to work for myself. I knew that I always wanted to work for myself. I didn't want to have a boss. I didn't want to work for a big company. I wanted to do it on my own. And that was always the kind of driver. And I always, there wasn't really a time where I thought I could make a living from it. I knew that I was going to make a living from it in some way or another. And that was, yeah, that was just my kind of belief system, was that I'll do it. But I mean, to get to the point that I actually was making a living from it wasn't as easy as that at all. There was a lot of kind of failed projects, failed businesses, a lot of successes, a lot of really good things, a lot of trial and error, and a lot of kind of different approaches to things. So, like, you know, when I first left art school, I started making women's wear. I had a little studio in Glasgow, and I was cutting and sewing, making dresses, and I was embroidering all these things and combining different things. But there was no way of selling them. I didn't have any way of selling. I was working in a bar, and I was buying fabric with the money I was making from working the bar. And you know, I was working in a shop as well. So I would work sort of between like 40 and 50 hours over the space of like 3 or 4 days. So between kind of Friday and Monday, I would work all the hours between Friday and Monday.
Wow.
And that would leave me, and I was going out as well, partying in Glasgow and drinking loads and doing all sorts that you do at those times. And but that was to earn money so that I could buy fabric and pay for rent and stuff Monday to Friday and have like the kind of business head on Monday to Friday and try and build the business Monday to Friday. And then Friday to Monday was work earning money. And yeah, but I mean, that was a different time. There was no social media. It was a very different, you had to just kind of go out and try and get sales and stuff. And even at that, there was Glasgow at that time was very, very creative. So this was 2008, 2009, very creative place. A lot of graduates, a lot of, like photographers and makeup artists and hairdressers and musicians. And it was a really, really cool time. No one was making any money. Like everyone was doing the same. Everyone had just graduated and we were all still trying to kind of find our feet. And there was a global recession. So no one had any jobs and no one was spending money on like fashion stuff. So it was more, just a creative outlet really. But then it got a bit more sort of serious, I suppose, when I started speaking with the Scottish government and sort of saying, well, how do I start a business? How do I run a business? How do I get sales? How do I get the business out there? And they were really helpful. They were really supportive in making introductions, and there wasn't any money or anything. It was just introductions and support and resources and just kind of business support and sort of making connections and saying, well, you know, have you tried this? And I mean, at the time I was cutting and sewing everything, and they were kind of saying, you know, you're mad, you need a manufacturer, you can't do everything yourself, you need someone to make your stuff. And that was a huge light bulb moment, like, what do you mean someone else can make this? And so that was a real turning point. I mean, it seems very obvious now, but at the time it was like, no, I need to make it all because it's mine. So yeah, and then things started to change. I went to New York twice and like in consecutive years. Once with Scottish government, went over on a kind of trade mission, and then the second time, going to New York actually was probably a turning point, because that was a collaboration with Stolly Vodka, a vodka brand who ran this kind of global design competition, which I won my part of it, and that kind of opened my mind to working with other people and collaborating up as well, and saying, well, here's what I do, and I'm Glasgow's, you know, Glasgow's it's the big town in Scotland, but it's still a very small place. So I'm in this kind of small town, this small city, but I'm creating this really interesting stuff. How can I collaborate up? Who can I collaborate up with that can take me to the next level? And I've always kind of had that mindset. And I think that's probably what embedded it, that first one with Stolly that took me to New York. So
yeah, I didn't know the Stolly story, but Russian tartan, who would have thought?
Well, that was it was a long time ago, and that was, it was really, you know, I keep going back to this thing that there was no social media. There really wasn't. Like, there was Facebook, and I think that was it. And yeah.
MySpace.
MySpace, and then Facebook came off the back of that, and it was that's all there was really. And this was like a design competition, like a global design competition that they ran on Facebook, which now you think that's insane, you know. And but. Yeah, it was like a design competition. I designed some women's wear, and then it was about getting exposure, I suppose, getting views on YouTube, and we made a little film about it. And it was really good. That was really cool.
It's refreshing and reassuring that there are good sides and positive things happening from social media, because it's getting kind of out of control. And we'll talk about these collaborations that you just talked about, you know, doing it with other people like Stolly, and we'll obviously talk about your association with Brora Golf Club, and maybe Aston Martin, I believe you did as well. But stepping back a little bit, as a young man and as an artist, as you grew, what music, books, paintings, architecture influenced you the most?
That's a tough one. So I think different stages influenced different aspects. I think, while I was at art school, there was a lot of, like art school was really about kind of finding myself, and I think everyone says that. I went straight from school. I started art school when I was 17, to the point that, you know, we weren't allowed to I think I'd just turned 18 when we started, but I had friends who were still 17 when we enrolled, and we weren't allowed to drink in the bar in the union because we were underage. So I had friends that they were allowed to go in, but they weren't allowed to drink. So they had to put X's on their hands.
What's the drinking age in Glasgow?
18.
Oh, wow.
The official age is 18. I mean, everyone drinks underage, but officially in a kind of nightclub or in a pub, you wouldn't be served under 18. So we would go into the pub, into the kind of social pub. The guys that were under 18, the bouncers, the bar guys would put these big permanent marker crosses on their hands. Anyway, it's just an example of how we were very, very young. So I took in a lot of different sort of music and books and art and architecture and everything. I think I was just interested in everything. Like every term was something different. I went through a rockabilly phase, like loving rockabilly music and all this, and jazz, like went through a jazz phase. But the one like constant that stuck throughout me and throughout my whole life and then became bigger in my 20s was disco. Disco, wow. There was a huge, and this is really surprising, but it might be, There was a huge disco scene in Glasgow, probably about 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. This huge disco scene,
wow,
in Glasgow that I just absolutely loved. And it's funny because when you say you like disco, it's quite a statement. It's quite a weird thing. But there was a whole, it was the cool thing to like it was the really cool thing in Glasgow, and all the cool guys liked disco music, and it was played in all the clubs and stuff. Yeah, and it was amazing. But to have that confidence to say I like this, and these are the reasons that I like it, I think is quite a sort of coming of age thing to discover what it is you actually like. Yeah. But I mean, architecture, like in art school, we looked at loads of like Bauhaus stuff, and we looked at like Dadaist poetry and Dadaist filmmaking and things, and I really took all of that on board and was influenced by all of it, to a certain degree, and then I think you can narrow the focus. But even now, like I've got a process and a way of working that I always kind of come back to, but I'm very open-minded and very much I taught at the art school for a couple of years, and that really opened up my way of thinking as to how to be influenced by something. I think when you're at art school, you just take it all in and mm-hmm. you just accept it and that's fine. But when I started teaching there, it's different because you have to kind of know it first, you have to research it first, and then teach it on to someone else and show someone else how to appreciate something and how to almost critique something. So you know, rather than thinking, you know, do I like that or do I not like it? You're thinking, well, why do I find that strong? Or why do I find that interesting? Or why am I not interested by that? So it's just a different way of thinking. And I now apply that to kind of everything that I do. Mm-hmm.
I guess that just confirms the statement that curiosity feeds creativity.
100%. If there's times where I'm not, not feeling inspired or, just having a bit of a kind of block, I think it's really helpful just to start reading something or just looking into something that's like, yeah, pick up like an architecture book or an old kind of fashion book or something. Or like, I think there's a lot of reliance on the internet, and it's so easy to find what it is you want. Now you can go into Google and say what is this and what is this date and where is this came from, and even with AI as well, you can go into AI and ask a very open question and get loads of answers from it. But I think there's something really valuable in being able to pick up a book or a record or or a film and just get into it and not be thinking about the reason why. You're just putting it on and getting into it to be inspired, and something might come from it and something might not. But yeah, you're right. I think asking questions and being curious and being open to being inspired, it's definitely a driver. Yeah.
Yeah. And then at some point you moved from the discos of Glasgow to the Highlands of Scotland.
Yeah.
How the hell did that happen? And how did it change you?
Oh, massively. So the kind of disco stuff was like I was a big I loved going out, loved partying. I worked in bars all my adult life. I worked at night in bars and
nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, nothing at all. And it absolutely shaped me as a person. Gave me the confidence to speak to people and to do all that sort of stuff, which is great. Learned a lot in bars, met a lot of amazing people. But it's very much a culture of drinking and doing all sorts and partying all night and through into the small hours and things. And I did that for a long time. And there's only so long you can do that for, really. And when we moved to, so I was born and bred in Glasgow, worked in Glasgow. And I moved to Ayr, which is on the southwest coast of Scotland. But I didn't quite give up that kind of party lifestyle. I'd left the bar scene, and I was working full time in my own business, and it was going well, and I was making money and things like that. We had a house that it was a really nice house and stuff, and we had our kids. But I was still kind of getting the train to Glasgow, and Glasgow's about an hour away. I was still getting the train to Glasgow and still going out quite a lot and things, and I hadn't quite made that shift yet. But then COVID hit and changed the game. Oban is a little seaside town on the northwest coast of Scotland. We've got family up here, and my wife and I have been coming up for about 10 years. And after COVID, we were here on holiday, and we thought, why are we living in Ayr? We've got nothing there for us. We didn't want to move back to Glasgow. We didn't want to go back to that life. And we saw Oban as a real new chapter in our story, and bringing up our kids as well. Our kids were very young when we moved, and it really did change me, because the pace of life is very different. I used to come up here quite a lot, so I would come up and meet clients and measure them for kilts and things. And I would come up, you know, once a week, get the train up to Oban and measure people for kilts. And everyone was late. Every appointment, everyone was late by 15, 20 minutes, and it drove me mad. I was like, why are you late? You know, well, what took you? And it was always, oh, you know, I met my friend just came off the boat, or I bumped into this guy, I've not seen him in years. And there was always a story, and it was fine, like that was fine, but it used to drive me mad. But now I'm here, I'm exactly like that as well. And it's such a slower pace of life, it's such a more relaxed pace of life, and it's just, it's very... It's very seasonal as well. So the weather in the kind of off season in the winter, between kind of September and April, the weather's terrible. It's freezing cold, it's wet, it's dark. And people, it affects people differently, because in the cities, I don't think the weather affects people that much. Everyone does their same work, you know, all around the year. They do the same work, they do the same thing, they have the same routine. Whereas here, it's almost impossible to keep that same, you know, the jobs aren't here, the tourists aren't here, the town isn't as busy, and the weather's awful. So, and it's dark, it's not, you can't maintain the same life 52 weeks a year. You have to change slightly. That's definitely changed me a lot. I've learned a lot about Scottish culture. When you're in Glasgow, you know, I think Scotland, I was speaking to someone about this today, Scotland is a very, very small country, but it's very diverse, and you can go 2 hours in any direction and you're in a completely different place. For me, being in Glasgow, you don't really learn about Scottish culture and Scottish history and Scottish heritage and like Highland culture. You just don't learn about it at school. You're not taught it, and you don't know it at all. But coming up here, there's so much. Like my kids go to a Gaelic school. Like they're fluent in Gaelic. They're only, you know, 8 and 6. My daughter's at Highland Dancing. My son plays shinty. You know, these are very traditional Highland pursuits, which I had no knowledge of in Glasgow. But you know, Glasgow's a lot more contemporary. There's a lot more sort of global culture and global conversation that goes on in Glasgow. There's a lot more kind of opportunity in Glasgow and Edinburgh. But it's, I suppose it's you know, you take from it what you want. And my wife and I wanted that slower pace of life. And that's what we got.
Yeah, it sounds like you're enjoying it. But would you say that you're more productive or differently productive in those dark months from September, from October to April, than in when it's light until midnight?
I think it's productive in a different way. So in terms of work, I think I'm probably the same. Because I think you're more motivated in summer to kind of get more work done and you know, chase more opportunities and things like that, and that's great. But you're also more inclined to take time off, and I'm very fortunate that I've built it myself, but I work for myself, and I wanted to work for myself so that I could take time off and spend time with the kids. And you know, if it is a beautiful sunny day, I can go to the beach and I can go and swim in the sea, and I don't need to ask a boss if I can do that. And that's what I have designed for myself. Yeah. Whereas in the winter, it's quite easy to just, you know, just kind of hunker down and get on with work and get on with stuff that if it was a sunny day, you might not do it. It's quite easy to just say, right, it's pouring rain and I'm not going out. I've got this to do. I'm just going to sit at my desk and just get this done. So I think it's a different, definitely a different way of working.
As somebody who enjoys sweating on the beach tremendously, what's the temperature of the sea when you go swimming there where you are?
So it varies.
It's cold.
Yeah, I mean, in the winter, so we do it all year round. And in the winter, it can get sort of 5-6 degrees, like it is
water.
Cold. Yeah, the water's Jesus cold. Christ. Yeah, I mean, we're only at that time, at that temperature, we're in for like half an hour or something. We're not in very long. But in the summer, I think the temperature can get up to, I don't know, maybe 12 or something is the kind of highs. But at that time, we do big, you know, we do like 10Ks and things. We do big distances when it's warmer. So yeah, it's great. Love it.
Let's talk about your business.
Mm-hmm.
I found a quote of you which says, I help brands capitalize on the value of high-end Scottish design with signature products that set them apart from the competition, creating lasting legacies through design. And you've mentioned this storytelling through textiles a little bit when you talked about the history of tartan. And maybe we can use the example of Brora Golf Club and how that came about, and the process you go through, whether it's a golf course or a vodka company a car company. Do you have any connection to golf?
Sort of. So I think what I do, actually, my phone is running low on battery. Can I take this moment just to pause?
Absolutely.
Just quickly, just to
absolutely
plug this in. It'll just be a second.
We're flying without a net, and we're back.
So
your
golf,
connection to golf.
Yeah, so golf. I think when you live in Scotland, you're connected to golf by default. You can't really help it. So I've lived in four different houses and three of them have been literally on a golf course.
Yeah.
You know, where I live now, the view that's in the screensaver there, that looks over the golf course. When I lived in Ayr, the golf course was on our back garden. You could get out the back garden and you were on the ninth hole. And when I lived with my mum and dad, the golf course was kind of at the top of the hill. And these are three very set. There's Glasgow, Ayr, and Oban, and the three big golf courses that we're close to. And that's not a unique story. There's a lot of people in Scotland who have that. So you're kind of involved with it by default. Same as football as well. Football's kind of ingrained in everyone. My dad plays a lot of golf. He always has. He's always been very interested in golf. But the my connection to golf through work, it kind of came about almost by accident. I was doing a lot of work in the whiskey industry, and then from whiskey, someone recommended that I speak to someone at a golf course, and they were quite interested in tartan. And it was actually another supplier who was already supplying another course with tartan products, and said, we've got this client that they would like their own tartan. How would you do it? Like, can you do that? And I'd done it for a few other clients. I said, yeah, let's have a think about it. Let's see, how do we apply, excuse me, how do we apply that to a golf course? And that was kind of the start of it, really. So yeah.
Yeah, well, you mentioned tartan products, and I looked at obviously your website and the Brora website and some press releases and things like this. We're talking way beyond cloth alone. I mean, we're talking about a range of branded textiles, and we're talking about a ton of accessories. I mean, I saw head covers for golf clubs and little coats for your whiskey flask, and obviously trousers, kilts, and even the lounge chairs in the bar. So, and we don't have to use Brora as an example. It would be nice if we could, but when a client comes to you and says, do what you what I, the quote that I just read, do that for us. How do you get inspired? What do you look for? I mean, from what I understand with Brora, it was a combination of the iconic holes on the golf course. It was the history of the club. It was Scottish golf. It was the turns flying around. It was the James Braid heritage. It was rustic, authentic, traditional, contemporary. It was everything. You immediately, I mean, how much, because you really want to get down to the DNA of your client, right?
And that's the difficulty. There are other, there are other people that do what I do, but I don't think anyone kind of does it in the same depth that I do. So I really try, and like my big thing is storytelling, and I think that brands and people love telling stories and hearing stories, and people buy from people, and people buy into people, and I think that the story is what makes that interesting, and it makes that connection. It makes things work, and I enjoy telling stories. I enjoy hearing stories. So I will go into a business, and I think I'm quite good at I think I'm quite good at doing both quite a wide angle and saying, well, what's the wider picture here? What's the wider story that we're trying to tell? But also looking at very small details and saying, well, what is really interesting that's being overlooked on a daily basis, that's actually really interesting and is something that needs to be told. Like Brora, there are lots of, the turns obviously is in the branding, is that turn, and the fact that they have these Arctic terns nesting on the course is amazing, and they've got connections to RSPB and all this kind of thing, which is amazing. But one of the things that I think is very subtle is the train that runs through the course. So trains and golf in Scotland are massively connected, and a lot of these Highland golf courses are connected via train lines that used to take people from cities or towns to the golf
Of
course.
course.
Cruden Bay are a perfect example of that. They had a tram that would take people from the train station to the Cruden Bay Hotel, and then they play on the golf course. So these trains and connections, I think, are really important. And with Brora, they use old train sleepers for the benches, and these are all like really weathered and really worn, but they're just really simple. It's like, three bits of wood. It's like a long bit here and then two bits here, and it's the sort of thing that it's not overly designed. It's not overly thought about. It's just there because it makes sense, because this is the wood that we've got here. Why would we buy new wood when we've got this wood? Just use it there, and we don't need an ornate carving or anything like that. We just need a bench for someone to sit on, and that's it, and it's there. I think that really tells the story of Brora. The golf course itself is really kind of rustic or authentic. There's not like bells and whistles. It's not. It's. I mean, I'm sure it is very highly polished, and the behind the scenes is very well oiled. I know that it is. But on the surface of it, it just looks really raw and really authentic and really like you're out there playing golf. There's nothing else to it. And you've got the elements kind of battering against you, and I think it's trying to get that across. Whereas there's other clubs that don't have that story. I mean, one thing that I found with this is, I've visited probably 10 clubs in the last kind of 18 months or so, and every club is very different, and it's not just a little bit. They don't just have a slightly different history from somewhere next door. It's completely different. The way that they tell the story, the story that they have to tell is totally different from one club to the next, and I think that's fascinating.
Well, you can only tell your own story.
100%, yeah.
I mean,
And
coffee. And people pick up on that immediately. And for me, it's very difficult to imagine, but whoever the client is, how long does it take you in prep work to really figure out the DNA and what you want to do? Because I see it as, and maybe I'm completely wrong, but it's a very important piece of the puzzle of what you do to connect the story to the colors that you choose.
100%. So that's where the colors come from, is these elements. So like with Broda, we use this really dark brown essentially, for the sleeper. It's almost like a kind of greeny brown, that you can imagine is like weathered sleepers. And then another part of the course where the terns were nesting, was like this kind of crushed up kind of pebble, which we call shale. And it's that kind of off-white gray. It's just really, really important. But then other courses that we've done, like Cruden Bay, they have this. I found this little thistle that's dotted around the whole course, and it's this vibrant purple. So it's bringing that ex like that exact. So there's being very literal in bringing colours that are exactly like on the course, but then there's other colours that you need to bring from story and almost kind of make up, but make sure it makes sense. So for Broda, we have a black running through it, which is a reference to the James Braid and 1924, and that came about because the black worked very well in the design. So it was almost like we have to have this black because it works really well, but how can we justify it? So there's two aspects to it. We have to have this black, and we have to have James Braid. So how do we marry the two? Because the James Braid doesn't really work for the blue, because the blue already exists within another part of the story. All the other colours kind of exist somewhere else. So is it that the black is representative of the James Braid 1924? And then thinking more commercially as well, because I'm very business minded, and it has to work commercially. And what we can do with that specifically, and think about other tartans as well, rather than just saying, well, it's black, we call it we've called it 1924 black. And so 1924 is when the course was redesigned. And what that does is that allows the team and the pro shop to introduce products that are just black but can be branded with 1924. So it just ties in. It's saying, well, where are the there's creativity and art and design, and then there's commercial viability and products, and the two have to meet somewhere in the middle. And I think that's what I'm quite good at.
I mean, the colors, like you said, you chose were the Brora blue and the Lynx gold, which I would imagine has a relation to the gorse and bloom on the golf course. I don't know. And the shale and the James Braid 1924, and then the red for the little birds. How time consuming is that process for you to figure that out?
So it depends on the client, depends on the project. There are some clients like Broda. Broda, I nailed it pretty much first time, and it didn't take long at all because it was, I could see it really clearly. When I was going around the course, when I was kind of building everything up, I could just see it kind of coming together as I was working on it. So that one actually came about really quickly. But then other courses that I've worked with, it will take weeks and sometimes months of revisions, and sometimes there's too much information, and sometimes there's not enough information. So it's about trying to, how do we bring, how do we get the story right? Because we don't want to rush it, but at the same time we have to get it done. But yeah, depends on the project, really.
So can I imagine it like the musician that you can take, I don't care, the Beatles, Miles Davis, whoever, who are working on an album or on a song, and they listen to it and they say, "Oh, we can do this better, and we can do this better." So you're your own musician and your own producer that finally says, "Listen, this is good enough."
100%, 100%. It was either like Kanye West or Pharrell Williams or something years ago. I remember someone interviewed them, and like I said, the Beatles or whoever, and the interviewer said, "How do you know when you've written a hit? How do you know when it's a hit?" And he says, "Because you listen to it, and it's a hit, and you just know, and it's your experience, and it's your." If, like a musician, when they hear something, they'll know something is off. They'll know something's not quite right. And if you watch musicians when they compose things, they'll do takes of it, and it'll just be not the one that you recognize yet. But then they'll just change one note, and it'll be like, yes. And everyone in the room says, "That's it. Yep, that's it. Don't change anything else." And I'm the same with design, and a kind of philosophy that I always go back to is that the design is finished not when you can add more, but when you can't take anything away. So when everything in that design stands on its own, to the point that if you took it away, the design would fall down, then that's it ready. But if you can keep adding something to it, then you're not finished yet. You have to keep stripping back, you have to keep getting away, to the point that everything in that design stands on its own, tells its own story, and complements the final thing.
How big is your operation? I mean, you said before that I can't imagine somebody else making my stuff. It's my, it's my stuff. How can I imagine that?
So not big at all. So it's just me that does the design work. I'll do all the kind of research, all the photography, all the research, photography, design work, presentations. I'll do all of that, and then I've got different sort of manufacturing partners that I work with. So different mills across Scotland. There's maybe five or six mills in Scotland.
Everything local.
Everything's made in Scotland. They make different weights of fabric or different qualities of fabric. So depending on the client, depending on the project, whatever we need, I'll go to a certain mill for it. And then I've got different producers who will take the fabric and turn it into like hip flasks or head covers or bags or whatever the product is. Again, that's all UK based. Not all based in Scotland, but some are in England. But all UK based. Nothing offshore. And yeah, I kind of trust them to, because I think I'm at the point where those types of pieces don't need designed. I've got to a point where I've got a sort of block of products that don't need any more engineering to them. They just need the fabric application. So I know what they're going to turn out like. I know the quality is good. I trust the producer. The price point is there for me to be able to work with them, and then to sell on to the client as well. But the creative part is all up to me, really.
So you have the design, but you only think about the design. You don't think, "Oh, this would make a great club chair, but it would maybe not make a great head cover." You just you're not involved in the selection of the accessories and
Oh yeah, no, I definitely am. No, I am. And I work
okay.
closely with the club, because I think the clubs are, there's a lot of clubs that are, they're a lot of clubs are retailers, and they're very good at retail, and they're very good at customer service and things like that. But there's a lot of clubs who, it's usually the pro, the golf, the club pro is running the shop and running the retail operation. And he's a golf pro. Like, his thing is that he's good at golf.
Exactly,
but he's not good at retail. So whereas I've worked in retail for years and I understand it and I understand people and things like that and products. So I think I'm quite good at being able to recommend different products and say, well, why don't we try this? And we could get this product in and give it a go, see if it works. We can add different labeling and things and packaging and see how we got on with it.
But it has to be a design that fits for everything.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Alan, how do we find you? Is it alan-more-designs.com? Is that your website?
Yeah. So you can search for that, or you can find me on LinkedIn, just Alan Moore, on LinkedIn, or Instagram. Yep, on Instagram as well. I'm kind of building a brand, a studio type thing called St. Conan's of Scotland, but that's maybe further down the line. But for the moment, yeah, if anyone wants to find me or get in touch, then yeah, LinkedIn is probably the best.
How big is your order book looking out in the future if somebody wanted to book you?
It's good, yeah. It's I mean, I'll always take on any client. I wouldn't turn it down. But yeah, I'm booked up kind of most of the year. September, I think I'm booked up till September. But yeah, I'll always take on and chat about a client and happy to entertain. I've got a.
Well, hopefully some of the listeners in the 97 countries that we reach will say, hey.
Oh, definitely.
We could use some tartan.
Yeah, I've got a client in Atlanta, Georgia, that I'm doing tartan for. We were just talking this morning about a golf club near Aspen that's thinking about tartan and
Colorado. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So we've got a lot of reach.
Are the Japanese there yet?
Japanese, I did a collaboration with a Japanese golf brand, which was really cool. But tartan, I think the Japanese is a long relationship build, where you get any sort of commitment. But we'll see.
There you go. Well, Alan, thank you very much for this fascinating hour and whatever. But the history of tartan, your personal story and the story of your business, I appreciate very much you being here today.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you, and thanks for the opportunity. I really, really appreciate it.
Let me leave you with this one. May Oban be from now on be known not only for the home of Bobby McIntyre, the great golfer, and its whiskey, but also for Alan Moore.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was it. To the Linksland.